Good evening. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to St. Nectarios. We've had many blessings here in the past couple of months. I work with the Adult Religious Education Ministry, and we've been blessed to have some great contributors to our program of religious education. It's ironic that just 2 months ago, I believe, right here, we had Opera Carolina make a presentation to a full crowd, as we have tonight. And so, just to keep equal balance, we thought we'd have a presentation tonight from a rock star to balance out the equation. I was hoping he was going to bring his guitar because I would have brought mine and we would have a jam session. But we did better than that. We've been really blessed to be involved in the tour that Father Thimi Adamopoulou has conducted. He has several people with him, and I'm sure he will introduce them. But the things this man has done, this wonderful father, in establishing hope for children, is very close to the hearts of St. Nectarios, because we too believe very strongly in the missionary work as conducted and organized by our projectionist today, our Minister of Missions, Tim Klund, who has done wonderful things with our program here, Children of God. And Father Thimi has done so much in the same aspect. And he will tell you the story of his conversion, how he came to understand that this was going to be his mission in life. And the plight is just a wonderful thing. He has an amazing background. He was, surprisingly, because he doesn't sound like it when you speak with him, but he was born in Alexandria, Egypt, one of the great original five patriarchates of our church. So he's here tonight after many years of studying in many schools, many master degrees and so forth, or every holy church, school, and so forth. He has an incredible background, and he brings with him, like I said, an incredible group of people to make an incredible presentation to all of us tonight. We are just really lucky, really, really lucky, and really, really honored to have Father Thimi Adamopoulou. Father, are you around? Here we are.
Good evening, brothers and sisters and holy fathers. There are some very distinguished people here. We're all distinguished, but I'm aware of the presence of people like Mr. Hank Handegraaff, who's here, very prominent man in the Christian media circles. I'm aware of Mr. Buchanan, Georgia, and Bob Buchanan, great contributors to our mission in Sierra Leone. I'm aware of all our friends and supporters who are here. But above all, I thank our Lord Jesus Christ, our good friend who takes care of the poor. I want to begin by showing you, in the words of Mao Zedong, one picture is worth a thousand words. One picture is worth a thousand words. And the reality of mission work in Africa is uncharted territory. You will not find in the books of our Holy Fathers, for example, how to deal with an Ebola crisis, right? John Chrysostom does not mention Ebola, okay? I'm telling you right now. But what they do mention, which is interesting, is the plague. So the closest I had, how do I deal with Ebola? What do I do? The country was now struck down. This is going back 2014-15. It's struck down with this extraordinary plague. What does an Orthodox missionary do in Ebola time? So the closest I got to our tradition, the Holy Fathers and the Holy Scriptures, is the plague, the plague in the Middle Ages, the bubonic plague. How do the fathers understand that? What did they do and say What does church history tell us about the bubonic plague, and how did the church respond to it? And that was part of the guidelines that I had for dealing with the Ebola crisis. There were prayers sent to me from Greece, from a monastery, pertaining to plagues. I couldn't believe that here we are confronting in the 21st century something that confronted the church 600 years before, 700 years before. And there we were being confronted with this extraordinary, deadly virus, which, by the way, there is still no cure. And what I must say is that something I did say on Hank's radio program, subconscious racism. We are not racists. We all want to help other people, no matter what race it is. But there is subconscious racism, and I've seen it living in Africa. This is how it works. That when Ebola hit us, and I was seeing people dying, and there were corpses in the streets, and people didn't want to touch them because if you touch an Ebola victim, you're going to get Ebola, because the sweat and the blood will give you Ebola. And we were crying out. I was calling Australia. I was calling, Greece. We've got Ebola here. This is serious. People are seriously dying here, right? Now, the Australian government, I sent my sister, nothing. The American government wasn't really that interested. The British government, not really much interested. International doctors, not much interested. Believe it or not, it was the Cuban doctors who first came. The Cuban, I don't get it, What were the Cuban doctors doing there? They were there. That's an amazing thought to think about, But when did the international community respond to the Ebola crisis? They only responded when Ebola came to America. Suddenly, we've got Ebola on our hands. Suddenly, we've got to find a vaccine to eradicate this deadly virus. Suddenly, we need all the pharmaceutical companies to do serious research on Ebola. Ladies and gentlemen, Ebola has been with us in Africa since 1976, when it was discovered in a small village by the river, Ebola River in the Congo. That's where it gets its name, and killed the whole village, including some Roman Catholic nuns and fathers. And it was only by chance that a Belgian doctor was there and he analyzed and found Ebola. But since 1976, now ladies and gentlemen, imagine if we had a deadly disease in the middle of Europe, in Switzerland. If we had a deadly virus in the middle of Great Britain, if we had a deadly virus in South Carolina, how long before the great pharmaceutical companies would get to work and do their research? But it was an African disease since 1976. Nobody really cared. And even to this day, after more than 40 years, there is no cure for Ebola. I call that subliminal racism. It's not overt, it's not conscious, it's not something that we are planning, against the black people. It's not like that. It's just that it doesn't hit us, it doesn't affect us. So we don't really bother with it, you see. And that's what I have seen in Africa. This, we can't be bothered, which I call subliminal racism. Now, again, I don't want to make anybody feel guilty here. This is not a guilt trip, okay? I'm just explaining. Let's put it this way. I'm giving you the voice of the people of Africa whom are silent and cannot be heard. For better or for worse, whether I like it or not, I have this responsibility to be the voice of the voiceless to you and to others that God has given me the privilege and honor to be among. So, what I'm going to do with the first presentation is to take you for a small trip through our Ebola crisis. I think that's a good introduction into our mission work and what we are doing there. You know, people were surprised that I stayed on when Ebola hit. The Africans say that whenever there's a war or a crisis, the white man leaves, right? And that happened. Most organizations in Sierra Leone, they left. The American government issued a warning. Nobody is to go to Sierra Leone. It's a travel alert. And then all non-essential members of the United States mission in Sierra Leone left. All the big companies left. And basically, we were left with hardly any white people for that period of time. People were expecting me to go too, but I stayed. And they came and they said, now we know that you are sincere. Now we know that you are with us. Now we know that you're one of us. And that was the greatest compliment and the greatest satisfaction that I could get. And it came through this most unexpected way, the Ebola crisis, imagine. Now, let me take you through Ebola. And imagine North Carolina without hardly any hospitals. Imagine North Carolina where the medical infrastructure is almost non-existent. Imagine North Carolina that if you have lung cancer, there's nothing that can be done for you. You have to go overseas. Imagine North Carolina that has no cardiologist. Imagine North Carolina that cannot treat you with tuberculosis. Imagine North Carolina that if you want to have an eye surgery, you have to go to New York. You have to go to New York, you see. This is the medical conditions that we face there constantly. And then, of course, there is the demographic as well, that if you are poor, you will get second-class treatment in the hospitals. And if you have money, you will get better treatment, but within the limitations of their capacity and their abilities and their resources, which are flimsy and very low. One good thing that has come through the Ebola crisis is now the government, all of us there, are really become aware of the weaknesses of the medical system. Now, we're going to show you the first one, which is the whole crisis. And then what does an Orthodox church do in the middle of an Ebola outbreak? Well, we stumbled our way through. But here's the good news. No Orthodox was affected by Ebola. Not one of our sheep, not one of the flock died from Ebola. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Okay. All right, can we have the lights off here, please? Did you understand what was going on at least?
Yes.
This was our attempt to survive in the crisis, and we received a lot of help eventually through our sponsors, both in the United States and in Australia and in Greece, through Paradise Kids Australia, USA, and the different Greek sponsor groups. What we were showing there is how it hit the nation, the shutdown, the various procedures that were adopted, and then eventually the international aid that did arrive and did help substantially. And in a way, we stopped it there before it would spread to the rest of the world. So we fought an international battle, actually, to prevent Ebola from spreading out. And so that was, even though it was local, it had global consequences. And that's basically what we were trying to show you. I don't know whether we can improve the sound and how we can do that. I'm going to put the microphone close to there. Perhaps that will improve it. Now, the next DVD talks about all our work there, everything we are doing, not just in terms of Ebola, but also the school systems we have established, the clinics, the housing for people who are disabled or the victims of the civil war. Those of you who have seen Blood Diamond, Blood Diamonds is about Sierra Leone, the film, and it's a true story. I mean, not the film itself, but the Blood Diamond story is true, that the rebels would chop off arms and they would chop off legs. And we have many, many people in Sierra Leone with amputations of limbs and legs, arms, the whole thing. Babies were not spared. Children were not spared. Women were not spared. Men were not spared. It was absolute catastrophe. So we have created a compound that we've taken in some of them, including the polio people, because polio people have no rights. It's not like here, if you have polio, you will get certain government assistance, certain privileges, certain rights. It's nothing like that. You get polio, survive. You have to survive, and you'd be lucky to have a wheelchair. Many of them just crawl on the ground. So essentially, we've taken in a community of disabled people, and we are feeding them, clothing them, sheltering them, educating them, and trying to remove that anger, that hostility that is inside of them since they were little children, because it is thought that if you are disabled, you've been cursed. You have a curse. So they want to keep you away. And you will see in the next one how even children with polio are abandoned, because to take the curse away from the rest of the family, you will see that. Okay, so now you saw part of our work and what we are doing there. The school systems, you saw our schools, our children, you saw the clinic, you saw the future orphanage, two orphanages for the children whose parents have died of Ebola. You saw our college. We have a training college in IT and teacher college, so that we are training people to become teachers in early childhood education. That is to say, the kindergarten and junior primary school. So we are empowering them to get a job, because to go to these colleges is very expensive. So we provide that opportunity for them. So we're also giving people the chance to get a job, 60% unemployment rate in Sierra Leone. Besides, of course, the spiritual aspect, which is the gospel, the orthodox way of understanding the world and the scriptures and the faith. We are in a nation that is half Islamic and half Christian, and we are finding that we are getting many, many converts. Every time I baptize, there is a list of about 50 people, but I kind of narrow it down to about 12 to 20. And so the possibility of bringing thousands and thousands of people into Orthodoxy, for those of you who are interested in that, is immense. But due to the lack of manpower or woman power, we are not able to fulfill our potential for growth. You know, Jesus said, go to the whole world, preach the gospel, and baptize people, and make them disciples. Well, we are doing that in addition to the philanthropic aspect. So it's not, as James says, St. James, if someone comes to you in need and you say, well, look, I'll pray for you, brother, I'll pray for you, but you do nothing to physically help, then according to James, that's half the job done. But if you pray for someone, then you help them physically, able, materially to help them, you've done the whole job. So that is what we are emulating, that is what we are aspiring to do, to preach the gospel, but also to obey the teachings of Christ concerning poverty, malnutrition, sickness, disease. I was sick and you came to me, as the gentleman was talking about prison. is part of that litany of obligations that we have, that Christ has put upon us as Christians. So, without further ado, I think you've seen it now, and perhaps I can hand it over to you now for some kind of Q&A, a question and answer. I'll be happy to oblige. Thank you for being patient, and particularly with the sound system. Okay, let's go home. Are there any questions? Yes, sir. All right, let's take it one at a time. So the first part of your question is the journey from rock stardom to missionary or Christian. Is that what your first question was? Okay. I grew up as a normal quote-unquote child in Australia, coming from Alexandria, of Greek parents, but I was never a believer. I never believed in God as a child. Never had any thought of God. And when I went to school, primary school and into high school in Melbourne, Australia, I went to secular schools where there is no teaching of God. And I didn't care, quite frankly, about that. And if anybody had spoken to me about God, I would just simply think that they're just, you know, a bunch of losers, you know. Naturally, one leads one's life. And as it happened during my late teenage years, there was this, it was the 60s, and the change of direction in music from Frank Sinatra and Elvis and Connie Francis and Neil Sedaka and so forth to a new style of music, to a new direction, which was coming out of Great Britain in Liverpool, the Beatles, the Mersey Sound, and it was quite fresh and very different to what we were used to from the, you know, American 50s phenomenon. And as a 17-year-old boy having just finished high school, I found it irresistible. I was already playing the guitar, but just as a hobby, but I found it irresistible, this new sound that was killing us as young men and women at the time. So we formed Australia's first Beatle, long-haired, new-look group. So we were the mods as opposed to the rockers. There was that sort of demographic teenage culture distinctions, okay? And we were very successful, and we had hit records, fan clubs. I had people staying outside our house just to say hello, you know, people just outside the front gate, just, you know, so many people just there, just waiting. And we did a tour with the Rolling Stones at the time. They were very big, Mick Jagger and all these people. And for a teenage boy, that was like a dream come true. I couldn't believe it. You know, here I am talking to Mick Jagger. Wow, you know. It meant a lot at the time. But then when the rock fame, and that's what I want to talk to young people. Anybody here who wants to be a rock star, here is how it goes. If you make it, and not necessarily you will make it, but let's say you make it, how long do you have? 1 year? 2 years? 3 years? There's an expiry date. After that, they don't want to know you because somebody else comes along and takes your place. A new group comes along, a new singer comes along. Imagine how Elvis felt when the Beatles came on the scene and dethroned him. Imagine how he felt. You know, he was like a national icon from the 50s, middle 50s to the early 60s. Then these foreigners come and knock him off his perch. This is what rock music is. One day you're famous, the next day you're forgotten. Or football players. You have your moment of glory, and then it's all over. Baseball players, You have your moment of glory, it's all over. You're not going to last forever playing baseball. You're not going to last forever being a rock star unless you're a Rolling Stone. I don't know how they do it. You know, I always thought Keith Richards would die a long time ago, but God bless him. So basically, that faded out. It faded out. It's a natural course. It fades out. So what do I do now? Well, I go back to university. That's what I knew. But at university, it was now the late 60s, Vietnam War, LBJ, American troops in Vietnam, Australian troops in Vietnam. We've got a war on our hands next door to us. For you, it was very far away, but for us, it was very close. It was next door. Vietnam is very close to Australia. But we, the students, thought it was an unfair war. It was an unjust war. It was a war of imperialism against the proletariat, against the peasant, the Vietnamese peasant, who wanted independence, who wanted unity between North Vietnam and South Vietnam. So we protested against the Vietnam War, and we were, you know, smashed in the head by police and so forth. But we did it. We won, and we stopped the Vietnam War. We stopped it. But during that period, I was very much influenced by what is known as neo-Marxism. Neo-Marxism believes that the world is divided along economic lines. The rich control the means of production. The workers are exploited and they are dominated by the rich. And they will live the rest of their life as pawns in the hand of the rich, you see, who don't care for them. This is a Marxist economic analysis. And we thought that was true. We believed that. So I would go into factories as a 19-year-old, 20-year-old neo-Marxist, and I would try to use the Marxist tool towards the revolution, the revolution of the working class against the bourgeoisie, the middle class. And how the revolution works is by strikes. You strike. You go into factories, you provoke the workers, you tell them they're not being paid enough, you tell them that they're being exploited, you spread the gospel of Marx, and then you get them to strike. Once they strike, that's the beginning of chain of strikes. And the aim was for us to bring about a series of strikes in Australia that would bring down the government, and then hopefully the socialist government would take over. So that was the so-called socialist utopia. I know in America all this sounds crazy, I understand that, but nevertheless that's what we went through. That was and atheism is part and parcel of that ideological perspective. For Marx, religion is the opium of the masses. The churches give us religion in order to tranquilize us so that the rich will exploit us. And they will say to us, the poor, look, don't worry, you'll get to the kingdom of heaven while we will not, you see. So to that degree, we believed in that. We believed in that. Now, what happened was, how come Christianity? That would have been the last thing in the world that I would have imagined. I would have thought myself a traitor to the revolutionary cause. I would have thought myself our hero, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro. I know you don't like this, but I'm just telling you. I hope I don't get kicked out of here, brother. Anyway, so how would someone who respects Che Guevara, how can someone who respects Fidel Castro, how can someone who respects Mao Zedong, right, become a Christian? It's impossible. It's inconceivable, right? Hello? Are we together? Am I still safe? Oh, hallelujah. So what happened was that one day, now the Beatles, they go to India and they meet up with somebody called Maharishi Yogi. And then they bring out this message that, hey guys, it's not just a Marxist revolution that we've got to talk about. We've got to talk about a transcendental revolution. And we're going, what? How can you talk about religion? Religion is the enemy of the people. How can you possibly? John Lennon, you're a traitor. George Harrison, you're a traitor. Bob Dylan, you're a traitor. What's going on here? We were confused. How can it be that John Lennon would talk about transcendental meditation? That was inconceivable. But something dropped. And I began to wonder, What's this about meditation? What's this about the possibility of a supernatural world existing, a metaphysical world? Because for us, the young atheists, there is no world after this life. There is no life after death. All there is here, nothing else. And so you do the best you can here. After you die, you die. There's nothing after death, right? So we believe that. But now they're telling us there's something beyond the physical world. There's something extra going on. So I began to look into this by going to the Hare Krishna temple, staying there for a while, looking at them, reading the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the Indian holy books, and wondering about this Krishna consciousness and what it was all about. And we would recite Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Krishna, and so forth. And it was thought through these meditative mantras that we would achieve cosmic consciousness and be united to Krishna consciousness. But what happened one day was, as we were in the Krishna temple, they had us to wash the statue of Krishna and then to drink the waters. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to drink the water of a statue that's been washed. And as a result of that, basically, I was not kicked out, but I kicked myself out of the Krishna temple. And then I thought, okay, Krishna is not where it's at. Where is it? Where is it? Where do I look for ultimate truth? Okay? Now we're now in the early 70s. And the next thing that came along was the gurus. The Indian gurus came along. Okay? So now we chose a guru. The guru was representing a 14-year-old, rather plumpish young Indian boy who claimed to be God. He was the avatar. Okay? So I thought, hey, that's cool. I'm going to check out the avatar. All right? So I went to the ashram and I began to meditate according to the principles that these people had. And I was, you know, lotus position, blah, blah, blah. And the guru would come and touch us on the forehead and supposedly give us wisdom. So boom, 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 boom. Then he came to me. And I mentioned this to you, Hank, on the radio program. And I was wearing a cross at the time. But that was not because of any faith. It was more likely because of Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, all right? Okay, I'm getting some response here. Okay, so that was just a fashion statement. Oh, by the way, I also had a beret along Che Guevara with a feather. I don't know what the feather was doing, but it was there. So now, This guy sees the cross and he goes, "You will remove the cross." That's a French accent, I'm sorry. I don't know how to do it. That was Peter Sellers, you know. Anyway, whatever Indian way of speaking, right? Remove the cross. I said to myself, what on earth is this fashion statement upsetting him? Why would it upset him? It would be like, I don't know, wearing shoes or something, you know, that, you know, suede shoes or something, and then you say, remove the suede shoes. Well, you know, why would I remove the suede shoes? It's just shoes, that's all. Why do I remove the cross? It's just the cross. It's just like Led Zeppelin, man. It's all, you know. And he goes, no, you have to remove the cross. So I became stubborn. L'esprit de contradiction. I became stubborn. And I said, no, I'm not removing the cross. He said, well, you have to go. Okay, I'll go. Finish. So that was my ashramic experience for one or two days or whatever. And then I thought, the cross is upsetting a guru. The cross is upsetting a divine disciple of the avatar. What does that mean? And so that started a chain reaction that led me eventually to draw back from the whole Marxist movement, from the Indian guru movement, from the Krishna movement, from the hippie movement, from the Woodstock movement, into an outsider now looking in, sort of going out to see what is truth, what is reality, what is ultimate reality. And this, what I'm going to tell you now, is difficult, but I will tell you. And please don't misunderstand it. In that process of seeking, the Lord was gracious to me because there was no way I would have become a Christian. There is no way. There is just no way I would have become a Christian. But what happened was that I received what can be described as mystical experiences where I felt Christ out of nowhere. It wasn't as if I prayed and I said to the Lord, Lord, I would never pray. I thought prayer was something, you know, for other people, not for me. I don't need to pray. Prayer are for the weak, they're not for the strong. Prayers for those who rely on a superior force that they think exists and does not exist, right? So I would not pray. But this thing happened by itself and it just hit me like a 10-ton truck. And when I had that experience, it was actually one or two or three experiences of that nature, I realized that there is Christ. I realized there is a God. I realized that I was absolutely wrong and that I was heading towards the wrong direction. And I realized right there that I had to commit my life to Jesus because that was the truth I was looking for. It was always in front of me, but I rejected it. I didn't want it. Because I associated Christianity with, in Australia, Christianity is associated with the colonial class, with the British who came and brought convicts to Australia and they imposed the Church of England and they mistreated people. So for us in Australia, in a way, Christianity is seen as an instrument of the colonial class. No longer now, but it did have a tinge of establishment to it. And young rebels don't go for establishment, okay? Unless Donald Trump, can convince the establishment here. But that's another story. Now, here is what happened as a result of that. I dedicated my life to Christ. I dedicated my life to Christ. And a whole new journey begins now. All my friends discard me. They think I'm a wacko. You know what I'm saying? I keep talking about Jesus, man. Jesus is the answer, you know. Hey, what's the question? You know, I don't need no answer, you know. You know, I'm going on buses. I'm telling the conductor to believe in Jesus, you know. I get a job in a school, right? And I got to make up for the fact that I'm a sinner. I got to make up for the fact that I've been so far away from God. Now I'm going to show God that I'm really sorry, and all those years I denied him, now I'm going to show him every minute I'm going to acknowledge him. So on trains, on buses, in the street, I'm preaching, I'm handing out pamphlets. And then I'm thinking, now, I'm reading the Bible, it talks about the church. I will establish my church and the gates of Hades shall not prevail. So I think, I've got to join a church, all right? Now, what church do I join? So I thought, hey, wait a minute, I was born Orthodox. Let me check out the Orthodox, okay? Are you ready? A young man of 22 with a university background in Marxism and Nietzscheism and Nihilism and Maoism, not to mention Cubanism, goes to the Greek Orthodox Church. Now, my Greek then was fairly broken. Pater, I meet this father in the church, okay? And I say to him, Pater, ego thelo, I want to talk to you about God. Thelo na miliso ya Theo. And I'm expecting some sort of, yes, my son, come this way, and I sit down here, and I will show you the way. Yeah, here is the Bible, here are the fathers, here is the monastic way, etc., etc. This is what I get. Άσε το Θεό εκεί που είναι, άσε μας ήσυχο. This is true. Translation. Did you get it or not? You got it? I think, Hank, did you get it? Did you get it? It's basically saying to me, don't get involved with the God thing now. Just forget about all that. And I'm thinking, huh?
What is this?
You know? Something, well, the Greek Orthodox Church, forget it. They don't believe in God. I'm leaving the Greek Orthodox Church. I'm going to check something else. So I went out, Presbyterians, Methodists, you know, I'm trying to find God. The Bible says there is a church that he built. Okay, where is it? All right. So I'm in now, I'll make a long story short, I'm in the Presbyterian church. Okay. And they actually accept me. I do a witness for Christ. They say, oh, yes, brother, welcome. You know, they were very good. They're very friendly. We go on camps with them. And, you know, they try to teach me the Bible. So I got the response I wanted from the Presbyterians. I didn't know much about theology, but I did know the Bible. And they reinforced the Bible. But something inside of me was saying, you know, why would God make you to be born Orthodox? And of all places, Alexandria, the famous Alexandria of the early church fathers. Surely, surely, it would not be correct for you to remain here. So I went back to the Orthodox, only this time I didn't go to the same church. I didn't want to make that mistake again. So I found another priest who seemed to be more, you know, conducive to my thoughts and so forth. And within 1 week, I was already Sunday school teachers because I kept talking the Bible, this, that Jesus said that, Paul says that. And they go, you'll do as a Sunday school teacher. So I became a Sunday school teacher after 1 week. That's pretty good, isn't it? Right. And then from then on, of course, it blossomed into a better understanding of orthodoxy, a better understanding of the church fathers, the tradition of our church, the liturgy, and so forth. And then eventually, theological schools, training, coming to the States, Princeton, Harvard, Brown, all that, having achieved all that. And then back to Australia to teach in a seminary. And after that, Mother Teresa. Oh boy. Now, this is what happened. I was doing very intricate academic work. Are we together? Am I boring you?
No.
Okay, all right, enough. Okay, now, I'm doing intricate research in Coptic texts. Coptic texts, the so-called Dark Hammadi texts, okay? Trying to work out whether Christianity, early Christianity, particularly the Gospels that are associated with these texts, or whether which way around and everything. And I did this incredible research, and I'm happy with it. And I go to deliver it at the university, and about four people turn up. After 3 months of research, four people turn up. And I'm thinking to myself, is this what I'm supposed to do? And then I was teaching in the Greek Orthodox Seminary in Sydney. I was trying to teach them biblical Hebrew, because that's the language of the Old Testament. You know, Bereshith bara Elohim hashamayim v'ha'aretz b'bochu etochu. Is that impressive? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, okay? In Hebrew, in the original Hebrew. Now, try to teach Hebrew to Greek seminarians. Matina vata pramata. You know, it's not going to work, right? So all these things, and then Mother Teresa. Ah, oh, Mother Teresa. Look at the work she's doing. An elderly woman. Look at the strength she has. Look at the people she's helping. And here I am. Academic work, which is good, but the bug entered me. So that's when I decided I'm going to move on to Africa. I'm going to move on now and serve the poor. I'm going to be someone who's going to try to make a difference rather than simply giving out intellectual knowledge, which is necessary for seminarian development. It's absolutely necessary. But I felt somebody else can do that, that I was being called to somewhere else. And that, my friend, is a short answer to your question. Yes, sir.
Speak to the danger of leapfrogging 1,500 years of church history.
Okay. What he's saying is this. When you study at Harvard theology, this is what happens. You begin with the New Testament, the Gospels, which, by the way, considered to be mythological. Can you believe it? I went to Harvard thinking, I'm going to learn from the masters of the New Testament. And what they're telling me was that this is mythological, this is mythological, this is mythological, this is mythological. The seminaries at Dallas and the other more conservative evangelical colleges are actually teaching the scriptures completely in the way that we Orthodox would understand. But places like Harvard and Yale, while they have the name, nevertheless, the actual content of their teaching is that Jesus is basically a myth. Harvard Divinity School. Unbelievable. Right? So I got in trouble many a times in class. Trust me on that one. But here's how it is taught. So Jesus comes along, whatever we can know about Jesus, and then Paul, they like Paul, and then the Acts of the Apostles, and then after that, nothing really much happens in the church. So the next big step is Martin Luther. So all those 1,500 years of Orthodox and Roman Catholic history is simply not really important. It's not important. So that's why a lot of people who do study theology in America and England and in Europe do not really know much about the Orthodox Church. Because in their theological studies, they will not be taught about the Church Fathers. They will not be taught. Or if they are, it's one lesson. They will get one lesson on monasticism. That's about it. You know, out of a whole, you know, two or three semesters. So basically, it's as my friend said, leapfrogging from the apostolic times up to Martin Luther, 1500 AD. And in the middle there is a kind of a vacuum that is not important, you see. That is a very sad trend in Protestant seminaries. Not the conservative ones, but the liberal ones, as Harvard Divinity School is. Yeah. Did you understand that? Okay. Thank you. Yes, sir. That's right. Out of... Well, I would like to think that, but, you know, I don't want to, you know, presume that. You know, only God can say that. But all I can tell you is hard work, help from here, from the United States. We receive gloves, masks, antiseptic, hand washes. Let me tell you a funny story. Are you ready? One morning I wake up in the middle of the Ebola crisis. And my hands are all red. Everywhere, red spots everywhere. On my legs, on my arms, on my chest. I got Ebola. Because that's one of the signs of Ebola, right? My friends, for about 20 minutes, I thought I had caught Ebola. I'm sitting on a chair sweating and I'm thinking, okay, and what's the next step now? I can't go out. I will contaminate people. I can't stay here. I need to call someone. The people who will come to take me will be those people with those out of space outfits, right? And they will put me in a clinic where other people have Ebola, and after 10 days you're a dead man. And then they will put you in a mass grave without even your name on a tomb. That's what I thought was going to happen. And then I tried to figure out, how come I got the red spots, which is part of Ebola, but I don't have diarrhea, I don't have vomiting, I don't have a fever. And then I worked it out. I was washing myself in chlorine. I'd burned my skin. It was the chlorine, you see. So yes, none of us got it, brother. Although I thought for 20 minutes I had it. I don't know if that qualifies as an Ebola victim. Ah, very good, very good. We are probably in Africa, the Orthodox Church, the most linguistically friendly jurisdiction in the world. For example, if you, if you go to Canada, you'll hear a lot of Greek, right, in the church, right? Even though hardly anybody can speak Greek, but you'll still hear ancient Greek, right? Okay. In Africa, we don't do that. We look at what is the language of the people, and to the Jew, I become a Jew. To the Greek, I become a Greek. To the weak, I become weak. To the strong, I become strong. Who said that? St. Paul. Okay? The polytropic, multi-adaptive Paul. The greatest missionary we know. That's his example, that you adapt to the colors of the local. You are like a chameleon. You change your color in accordance to your environment. If your environment is Swahili, you become Swahili. If your environment is French, tu deviens français. If your environment is Italian or whatever, venitomo italiano, si? Allora. So what we've got here is adaptation to the environment, linguistically, but not necessarily culturally, okay? So we do the English, which is one of the languages of Sierra Leone, and we, in the sermon, we will adapt Creole, which is pidgin English. Like, for example, we say, what's the time now? They will say, "There, how much o'clock now? How much o'clock?" Right? Greetings, when you meet somebody in Sierra Leone, you would say, "How de body, man? De body fine? How's the body?" You know, you get a medical report, you know. we do try to incorporate English and Creole, sir. And that's not just us. If you go to Kenya, you'll hear Swahili, you'll hear Kikuyu, Luo. It's linguistically adaptive. I remember the patriarch came to our mission, Patriarch of Alexandria, and I thought that he would like to hear more Greek. So when he came and he said, we were baptizing or something, and he said, do the Epiphany Tropario, you know, and Yordani baptism, man. So I started in Greek. No, English, you see. So we have our leaders who are friendly to adapting our thrust in the local colors and in the local manner, which is brilliant missionary tactic. Brilliant. You know? Right. Yes, ma'am. Do we have what?
How do you do everything? How do you do all the mission field work when you're not there?
Oh, okay. Well, if you train people well, educate them well, good question. The successful missionary is the one who is no longer required. Did you hear that? The successful missionary is the one who is no longer required. If I have to be there all the time looking after everything, I have failed. And we do have people who want to get their hands on everything. They have to control this, they have to control this, they have to control this. No, wrong tactic. You have to let go. And once he or she knows what to do, fine, you do it. Report to me when necessary. Do you know what you're doing? Yeah, fine, do it. No problem. You see, the only thing that I hang on to, among, of course, I'm a priest, the church service and so forth. Overall, I take care of the mission, overall. But through the different branches, through the different heads of departments, so to speak, what happens, what I do that others do not do, the check. I take care of the money because there is corruption, you see. If you give money to the wrong person, it will go. How many times? This is exactly what happened to Oprah Winfrey. That's exactly what happened to Madonna. They go to Africa, they build schools, they leave money with certain people, and then the money goes. And the school goes. You see? Not in all cases. I cannot say that. Not in all cases. But there is a tendency towards that. So I control the money. So when Paradise Kid sends $10,000, I make sure that the check that I will write will go to where it has to go. And nobody will be able to steal or to misdirect the money, because I have full control over the money. And not only that, but we are accountable to our overseas sponsors, to Paradise Kids USA, Paradise Kids Australia. We have to send accounting reports. When they send us money for a particular project, I have to, well, our accountant writes back reports how the money was spent. And if they don't believe us, we can show by receipts how that money was spent, you see. So we don't do everything. We are like the supervisors, but we do have departments. We have but that takes time. It takes time. It takes time. Yeah.
When you started the mission work in Sierra Leone, did the local government or the government in Sierra Leone welcome you, welcome the Orthodox, and are they still welcoming to
yep.
doing such good work?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, we have very good relationship with the government. Very good. I may see the president of Sierra Leone at least four times a year. I will see him on various issues. I see the ministers, in other words, the secretaries of departments in your country. I see them on a very regular basis, particularly the Ministry of Lands, the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Social Welfare. We are almost on first-term basis. We are now building two orphanages. They know already that I'm here. They know already what's going on. So I will go. When I go back now, I will go and give the Minister for Social Welfare a report about what I did here. Did I get some funds to continue to build the orphanage? And so forth. So we have very good relationship. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes. Not in Africa, no. The more north you go in Africa, particularly now we have, unfortunately, the jihadic ISIS movement coming into Africa through Libya. Through very bad policies of the West, destroying Libya, allowed this vacuum to occur, whereby the fundamentalist extreme Islamic movement has now moved into Libya and is moving south from Libya into other regions in Central Africa. That's a very big problem for us. Huge problem. And then we have a group called Boko Haram in Nigeria. Boko Haram believe that all Western education is haram. It is sinful. The only education should be the Quran, nothing else. Any other book except the Quran is sinful. And so they will apply only Quranic principles, including killing people, women, girls, kidnapping girls and selling them off or doing whatever they want. And all those things, unfortunately, that we associate with jihadic extremism, unfortunately. It is close. It is close to us. That's one of my concerns, but with the hand of God, at the moment, we don't have it there. But and the government is aware of that. And one of the things they did tell me when I first arrived, the president himself, he said, look, don't try to force people to convert. So I've taken that on board. And people come to us, volunteering to be baptized. And I assured you, you know, one third of my staff is Muslim, and they convert slowly to Christianity. I don't force them. I don't put any gun on their head or sword in their head and say, if you don't become a Christian, I will kill you, just like these jihadists are doing the other way around. We don't do that. We give them food, we give them jobs, we give them money, we give them cars, we give them all that is necessary, but I never force them. But they come, and they want to be converted. And I say, are you sure? Yes. So I convert people who are called Muhammad, I baptize them, and I call them Maximus. You see? No, well, good question. The president must be, if he's a Christian, the vice president has to be Muslim. If the president is Islamic, then the vice president has to be Christian. So they have this very good balance there. At the moment, we have that balance and we live perfectly in harmony. No problem. But if the fundamentalists begin to send in their, you know, their sheikhs and their teachers, and they begin to put the flame of Islamic fundamentalism, there will be a problem. We're just praying to God that will not happen. And I ask for your prayers as well. Yeah. Sorry, what was that?
What is the one thing that you've learned the most?
Oh, okay. Thank you for your question. I don't know what I can say about that. One thing I have learned being in Africa is that any idea that Africans are somehow, what's the word I want to use? They're not the same as us is wrong. They are just as intelligent, just as human, just as the same thing you feel, they feel. The same thoughts you have, they have. The same emotions do come their way. But there's a difference. They are very strong people. They are stoic. They survive with sufferings. They survive with pain. I'm amazed how much they can endure and still go on. And there's something else I've learned too. They are far more religious than the average Westerner is. Far more. Their faith in God is stronger, whether it be Islamic or Christian. Their faith in God is stronger. And that keeps them going. When I visit a member of government or a high official, for them to ask for a prayer is not unusual. I cannot imagine meeting the Secretary of State in Washington and him asking me to pray for him. I really can't. You know, unless I'm wrong. I don't know. I don't think so. So that's a big difference. Yeah, that's one of the things. All right. I don't